I'm going to start with something. Thank you, ushers, for passing those out. I'm going to start with something that I might have more appropriately said at share time. I would like to remind you that those who stand behind this pulpit depend heavily on your prayers. I'm not chiding anyone. God only knows what these last weeks would have been like if you hadn't prayed. But I will just confide in you that I've had some pretty rough rowing these last 2 weeks. I've struggled with confusion and spinning my wheels, with failing and feeling like a failure. I've disappointed members of my family, and I've had a hard time sensing God's pleasure. I've had a hard time prioritizing and focusing on the task at hand. And in working on this sermon, I thought it was never going to come together. At some point this week, I realized that whatever else may have been contributing to this, and I'm sure there are angles that I don't know, whatever else it was, I know the enemy was bent on sabotaging the work that God was wanting to do in and through me. So please do continue to do battle in the heavenlies for your leaders here. On to the sermon. I've entitled the message simply, Are You Free? If you turn to John 8, verse 31, it won't take you long to figure out where I got my title. I'd like to get your thinking started with a sketch of the life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I hope that is close. I'm not very German. Dietrich was born in 1906 to a prominent, influential German family. Dietrich ambitiously pursued an education, completing a doctorate of theology in a doctorate of theology in 1927. He began his journey in the Christian faith, investigating the intellectual component, but a variety of encounters and experiences led him to a life of radical faith and obedience. You may remember him for his resistance to Hitler's government. Early on, he was firmly against it, as the church in Germany failed to take a stand against the murderous cleansing that the Third Reich was pushing, Bonhoeffer became a strong proponent and a founder of a dissenting church movement called the Confessing Church. As soon as Hitler came to sole power, all church leaders in Germany were pressured to take this oath, and I quote, I swear before God that I will be true and obedient to the Führer, or leader, of the German people and state, Adolf Hitler, and I pledge myself to every sacrifice and service on behalf of the German people, such as befit an evangelical German. Not Bonhoeffer. He not only helped to found the Confessing Church, he also accepted the leadership of an underground seminary to train pastors for this counter church movement. As the situation became more volatile in Germany, Dietrich had the opportunity to travel abroad. He was in the U.S. at the time when he was wrestling with his duty to seek the good of his country, his home country, in some way, whatever that looked like. So in spite of a lot of pressure from his friends in the U.S., he chose to go back to Germany, into the fire, essentially, taking passage in 1938 on the last ship scheduled to cross the Atlantic because of the danger of war. Things took a controversial twist when his brother-in-law introduced him to a cluster of men determined to overthrow Hitler. The fascinating part of the story is that these men were in a government agency, This agency's job was roughly equivalent to the CIA. Eventually, Bonhoeffer felt like his best option was to join the agency and take his resistance underground. He was apparently fully aware of the implications. He was coming to grips with his role in this, even understanding and declaring that if he were involved in an assassination, he would be guilty before God. He did, in fact, work with the agency on two separate attempts to assassinate Hitler. Both seemed foolproof, and yet at the last minute, both failed. Literally, in the last one, it was actually seconds. In the last seconds, it failed. He was jailed in April of 1943 before the second attempt on Hitler's life was made. But that one was so daring that it was only a matter of time before the Gestapo began closing in on him and the others in the agency. After a dramatic prison experience and grilling and other things, he was executed 2 weeks before he would have been freed, because the U.S. Army, the front of the U.S. Army, came to the concentration camp where he was killed. You may argue with Bonhoeffer's political persuasion. You may disagree with his application of the New Testament principle of non-resistance, and he wrestled with that long and hard. But I don't see how you can criticize his commitment to obedience and integrity. Bonhoeffer is probably best known for his book, The Cost of Discipleship. Think about it. What did discipleship cost him? Our text starts off with Jesus' statement that his true disciples will know the truth and the truth will set them free. What did this freedom look like for Bonhoeffer? How did his commitment to Jesus' teaching set him free? That is the challenge I'm placing before you as we launch into this long text. I'll have a quote from Bonhoeffer at the end. Now, if you somehow tune out for the first two verses of this passage, you will miss the heart of the entire passage. The passage hinges on two key points in these verses. First, notice that Jesus is addressing the Jews who had believed him, or in him, if you check verse 30. Secondly, his central point in this discourse is this: if you continue or take up residence in my word, my teaching, you will be my true disciples, you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Now, the second point doesn't throw us too badly off balance, I suppose, but as you look down through this passage and notice the kinds of things Jesus says to these Jews who had believed him, what do you make of it? I think there is no mistaking the tie to the previous statement in verse 30, and I quote, "As he was saying these things, many believed in him." But why is he saying this to those that believed in him? Look at the strong statements he makes about them. "You are doing the works of your father," obviously not referring to either Abraham or God. "You don't understand me because you cannot hear my word. You are of your father, the devil." Why is he saying this to Jews who believed in him? Keep this puzzle in mind as we go through this text. I submit that solving this puzzle is vital to getting the central point of this passage. So ask, why is Jesus saying this to those who believed him or believed in him? I'm going to try something a little different this morning. Instead of reading this entire passage, it's a lengthy one, I'd like for you to go through it with a neighbor. That's why you have the papers in front of you. As you read through this, I'd like for you to do a little textual analysis, I'll call it, on this passage with your neighbor. Now, don't get intimidated. All we're going to do is a little marking up, and I'll give you instructions as we go. I think it'll help you get a visual overview of this text. Some of you do this in a limited way in your Bibles, but I've made these copies so that everyone can mark up the text without a permanent impact on their Bible. If you want to experiment more with this, I strongly recommend the use of colored pencils or highlighters. They're a great tool for this kind of thing. So, let's start by looking at what Jesus says to his audience. You may remember that in chapter 6, Jesus makes some strong statements about the sovereignty of God regarding man's ability to come to him. Here is one example from verse 44 of chapter 6. No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him. Now, today's passage offers a different mix on the issue of our choice versus God's choice or action. So the first exercise I'd like to do is to have you go through and look for every statement that Jesus makes, well, and maybe some that don't. some of the ones that the Jews say. Look for every statement that implies either man's choice or lack thereof. I suggest in the left-hand column, the left-hand margin, I should say, in the left-hand margin, you mark the first with a C for choice and the lack of a choice with NC for no choice. Somebody get us started with the first example that you see here. What is the first example of an implied choice or non-choice that man has? Abide, right out of the first verse. If you abide in my word, that's a choice that we have. You are truly my disciples. Very good. And so then in the column, in the left-hand margin beside that, you'd write C. Now, just for a little further, what is the next one that you see here? Either implied choice or lack of it. That's right. And I was seeing one before that, but you're exactly right. Okay. That is no choice. Good. Jump back to the verse ahead of that. I think where it says, you will know the truth and the truth will set you free, implies no choice. So I would put an NC beside that. Now, we don't have a lot of time with this, but I would like, and I'm not sure how to divide the people over in the overflow, you can pick one or the other, but I think just to cut the time down just a little bit, I'm going to have this, the ladies here, do this exercise on the first column and the men do it on the second column. And over there, you can split yourselves up however you wish. But let's get some doing both. If you can't tell whether a choice is implied or not, and I couldn't always, I put a question mark there. And I should also say that I found two verses where both choice and no choice were implied in the same verse. So you could mark both in that case. So I'll give you about a minute and a half. Can you speak? But you can do it for homework if you'd like. I don't think we'll take the time to go over it. I was wanting to do that, but I don't think we'll take the time to do that. If you look down through this, if you marked it like I did, you're seeing a lot more statements that imply choice. Now, whereas the John 6 discourse heavily emphasized God's sovereignty as it relates to salvation, this passage brings into focus man's responsibility. And if you think about John's reason for writing, this shouldn't surprise us. He said, "These things I have written that you might believe that Jesus is the Son of God and that believing you might have life in his name." John willingly reminds us that of God's role in man's salvation, but like he did in chapter 6, but he quickly will return to hammering man's role, and that is to believe in Christ and to continue in his teaching. Now the next exercise, I'd like to look at four repeated words or concepts that shed light on important themes in this discourse. Two of these are introduced in the pivotal verses that I already mentioned. The third shows up in verse 50, and the fourth one, the one I did last, is the one that's most frequent. It starts in verse 33. The first one is word, which means simply Jesus' teaching. The second one is freedom, as in the truth will set you free. The third one that I spotted was Father. Actually, that was the fourth one, but anyway. And I lumped in with that, I lumped children and offspring, since it's kind of the same concept, descendants as well. The fourth word I pegged was glory or honor. What I suggest you do is go through this and underline the related words or phrases. Then write the key word in the right margin. On the other side, the words that I would write are simply word, free, father, and glory, just to keep it simple. Here's where colored pencils would be nice. In some cases, I find it helpful to draw arrows from each reference to the other words that it refers to. For example, if you find all the references to Jesus' word or the word of God, draw an arrow from each reference to what it points to. Some of them seem to point back to the first occurrence of the word, but some of them don't. So in this passage, if you have the time, I suggest you do that with the terms word and free. Draw arrows from one to what it's referring to. And here again, I encourage you to work with your neighbor on this and perhaps to cover ground a little faster, you should split up. One of you takes the first column and the other takes the second column and circle the keyword, write the keyword, circle the word in the text and write the keyword in the margin. If you have time, draw arrows as needed. I'll give you maybe between 2 and 3 minutes on this one. Tests. Does anything become clearer to you as you look at it like this? I'd like some input from you. What are you seeing now that you might not have seen before? Just shout it out. Truth? Truth, exactly. Truth is pivotal here. Truth is very central. Not all have the same father. It's a big part of this discussion. That's true. Truth is intergenerational. That's right. That's right. If you're going to have freedom, the obvious counterpart is slavery. So there, you have both. Say it again, sorry. Oh, interesting. I'm not sure I caught that. Sun and truth are used interchangeably. That's right. So if the sun sets you free, you will be free indeed. Good point. And there was another one. Glorification, sorry? The glorification of God. That is Jesus' concern. And interestingly, God is concerned with glorifying Jesus, and Jesus doesn't worry about his own glory. Anything else that's popping out at you from this? Thank you. Let's keep moving. There was one other big statement that we won't really cover more in depth, but it was just as big as the first occurrence of it, where Jesus said, if you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, etc. The other one is, if anyone keeps my word, he will never see death.
That's a jarring big statement.
As I prepared for this sermon, I was conscious of the fact that some of you might remember a sermon I preached earlier this year where I emphasized that Jesus' call was to get off the fence. If you remember that one, you may think this one sounds rather familiar. Well, I might feel tempted to apologize if it weren't for the fact that this discourse does indeed have a lot. The John 8 discourse has a lot in common with chapter 6. And I might still feel uneasy preaching from two similar passages, just four sermons apart, if I weren't simply preaching through John's gospel. So, with your permission, I won't bother taking responsibility for either the sequence or the content of John's gospel. Now, that is not to say that my interpretation of the text is above scrutiny. Quite the opposite. I don't say it every time, but I truly do want you to examine closely what I'm saying. If my main point is not the main point of the text, please do this body here at Center a favor and come talk to me. I've tried to reduce this to an outline to give you a sense of the flow of the conversation, and I regret that. This should really be on overhead to help you follow, but you can kind of skim through the passage here as I try to reduce this to about 10 statements or so. The first statement condensed is Jesus. If you continue or take up residence in my teaching, you will be my true disciples. You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. The Jews respond with, sorry, but we're sons of Abraham. We're already free. We've never been slaves. Jesus replies, you're slaves to sin. As far as being Abraham's sons, your lives tell a different story. You're trying to kill me. And implied in that is, you're sons of the devil. The Jews have a response. If we're talking about parentage, at least we weren't born out of wedlock. We're legitimate children of God. Jesus replies to that, no, if God were your father, you would love me. But you don't love me. In fact, you can't even understand what I'm saying because you're unable to hear or absorb my teaching. No, God's not your father. The devil is, and he has always been a murderer and a liar. I speak the truth, and I am sinless, and it's because I speak the truth that you don't believe me. The Jews say, you're not even a real Jew, and you're demon-possessed. Jesus says, I'm not demon-possessed, but you dishonor me. But that's not my concern. I honor my Father, and he glorifies me. Jesus continues, if anyone glorifies me by keeping my word, he will never taste death. The Jews then say, you're worse than crazy. Abraham died, the prophets died. What kind of self-made superhero are you? And Jesus says, I'm not making myself out to be anything. That would prove nothing. But there's a problem here. You claim to belong to the very one who is glorifying me. That can only mean that you don't know or belong to him. I do know him and keep his word. Abraham saw my day and was glad. The Jews say, how can you say you've seen Abraham? And Jesus replies with that explosive statement that we can't fully grasp. Before Abraham came to be, I am. Now, I wonder, do you cringe a bit when you read how blunt Jesus was with the Jews? And these were believing Jews. We saw it in the first part of this discourse. Two, does Jesus expect them to warm up to this kind of language? It really flies in the face of what we consider basic diplomacy. But N.T. Wright paints a word picture that I think gives a legitimate explanation for Jesus' tone, and it also lays a solid foundation for the focus of this text. Wright asks us to imagine a person coming to power over a nation in a state of disarray. Sound familiar? He may He may have planned all along to be a leader like our own David, building consensus, steadily pursuing reform, seeking justice for all, earning respect by listening carefully. You get the picture. But suppose this person took office just as a great world war was erupting. Suddenly his plans have changed. His country is now thrown into a situation that needs a firm and responsible hand. Diplomacy will have to take a back seat. As best as he can, he now has to determine the right direction for the nation and rally and mobilize the people for action. Well, Jesus came into a similar situation. He had limited time to fulfill his mission on earth, and the state of the world he came to didn't afford much time for relaxed, casual conversations at Herod's vacation palace. He had to get those who would follow him on good footing, and he couldn't give time to coddling those who were unwilling to take the plunge and cast their lot. I think this sense of urgency is really quite well suited for the times we live in. I'll get back to that a little later. I'm only going to zero in on just a few points here. We don't have time for much of this. Let's start at verse 34. Jesus answered them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who commits sin is a slave to sin." And their response, wait a second, I said that wrong. I meant to comment on verse 33, where they say, "We have never been enslaved to anyone." The Jews were probably protesting that they had always maintained a spirit of freedom and autonomy, regardless what political power was over them. They probably were not arguing that they had never been under political, in political slavery. Now, while it might be debatable how well they succeeded in maintaining their spirit of freedom, Jesus went straight, just past that completely, went straight to the deeper bondage. Here's what Merrill Tenney observed. "This is a declaration of the profound truth that slavery is not inflicted from without, but from within." He then compares sin to a disease. Every fresh outbreak shows that a virus is at work, and with each new outbreak, the body weakens and becomes more vulnerable to further attack. Then he says, "As the sick man is the slave of his disease, so the sinner is the slave of sin. And unless intervention breaks the power of sin, the sinner is doomed." Well, we already pointed out that this statement implies choice, which makes it different from most cases of disease. But look now at a statement that seems to imply no choice on the part of man, and this is in verse 43. Jesus asks the haunting question, "Why do you not understand what I say?" And then proceeds to answer it in the same breath. "It is because you cannot bear to hear my word." Other translations say, including the King James, "You cannot hear my word," or "You cannot accept my word." Well, my reflex is to ask, why can't they hear or accept his teaching? And it makes me want to read a little further to check for further explanation, which actually will help in this case. Verse 44 does give us some clues. They can't hear or accept Jesus' teaching because they aren't of God. That's what Jesus says. Here's how Barclay explains it. "It is quite possible that a man may lack these something essential which will enable him to have the experience. A man who is tone deaf can never experience the thrill of music. A man who is colorblind cannot ever appreciate a picture." And he concludes with saying, "Unless the Spirit of God is in a man's heart, he cannot recognize God's truth when he sees it." So this is a case where the consequence that we don't choose was listed ahead of the implied choice. We can choose not to be born of God or to have His Spirit in us, but we can't choose the consequence. Without the Spirit of God, we will not be capable of hearing Jesus' word. Now I'd like to get back to the puzzle I presented at the beginning. As you glance over the statements that Jesus made about the Jews here, and as you look at the statements they made about themselves, how do you reconcile these to the fact that these were Jews who had believed Jesus or had believed in him? How does that make sense? Well, I have concluded that Jesus is, in fact, responding to the new belief of these Jews. You've started, now you need to continue in my word if you want to be set free. This might have been a belief, much like the nobleman of chapter 4 or others who began with a show me faith, let's say. But Jesus had no time for people who wanted to sit at the entrance, so to speak, who wanted just enough faith to make their lives comfortable. Let me quote Carson on this. The evangelist, referring to John, the evangelist includes all of this material not because he is trying to nurture the faith of fledgling believers, but because he is trying to evangelize Jews and proselytes who must carefully understand what faith in Jesus Christ entails. They too must count the cost. So John has his audience in view as he's writing this. Carson goes on to propose that in writing this, John felt the same compulsion to present the message in such a straightforward way that it would scare off, essentially, those who weren't serious about their faith. He was concerned that the church not be deluded with people who were Christian in name only. And it was not an unfounded concern. Remember the strong action God took in the months after Pentecost, when Ananias and Sapphira thought they could get the best of both worlds? The result was, I quote, "great fear gripped the whole church." Enough so that it kept others away who had motivations like Ananias and Sapphira. Listen to Paul's somber warning from 2 Thessalonians 1, verses 8 and 9. "He will punish those who do not know God and do not obey the gospel of our Lord Jesus. They will be punished with everlasting destruction and shut out from the presence of the Lord." I believe, as I've said, the call for us today is to sense the urgency, much like Jesus did, much like John did. I'm not at all sure that it's a stretch to compare our context, 21st century U.S., with the early days of Germany's Third Reich. A significant segment of the church in the U.S. is caught up in politics. I get the sense that for many who claim to be Christ followers, comfort and safety are more important than guarding a clear conscience and cultivating a pure heart. It's out there, right? I caution us to avoid thinking that this problem is simply out there. I would remind you that much of the Mennonite church in Nazi Germany caved in to political pressure of the government. Listen to this telegram sent to Hitler himself on September 10, 1933. I quote, "The Conference of East and West Prussian Mennonites, assembled today in Tegenhagen, Free State of Danzig, feels deep gratitude for the powerful revival that God has given our nation through your energy and promises joyful cooperation in the upbuilding of our fatherland through the power of the gospel, faithful to the motto of our forefathers, 'No other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ.'" Now you caught, that was addressed to Hitler himself. This church feels deep gratitude. The conference feels deep gratitude that is happening because of Hitler's energy, and they promised joyful cooperation to him.
Now catch this. Hitler actually personally replied to this telegram. I quote, "For your loyalty and your readiness to cooperate in the upbuilding of the German nation expressed in your letter to me, I express my sincere thanks." Compare that. These Anabaptists, these two kingdom Anabaptists, compare that to Bonhoeffer, who was dangerously outspoken against the Third Reich. 2 days after Hitler came to power in January of 1933, Bonhoeffer sounded the alarm on public radio, decrying Hitler's agenda and warning the country to beware of giving their allegiance to Hitler. Gerhard Rempel, a former professor at Western New England University, dug deeply into the story of the Mennonites of Danzig and their willingness to participate in the Holocaust. Not only did Mennonites very conspicuously turn a blind eye, they avoided helping the Jews, some of them were actively involved in the crimes against the Jews. I can give you the link if you're interested. It's sickening. He said they wrestled with, quote, "the tension between the demands of survival and the tug of a moral conscience below the surface, embedded in the Mennonite heritage and religious upbringing." The tug. Survival or conscience? That should make our blood run cold. The expediency trap was set for them just as it is for us. Are we going to make decisions based on what is safe or on what is right? Are we going to sell out to outward freedom at the expense of soul slavery? Or are we going to sell out to Jesus' teaching and let the truth set us free? Consider the irony of the 20th century German Christians falling into the expediency trap and ignoring the plight of the Jews in Germany. Jews whose ancestors had found it too costly to heed Jesus' calling to abide in his word and find true freedom. Consider that irony and shudder. No, the problem is not out there. A look at Ken Miller and Timo Miller's case should warn us that the temptation to compromise is near at hand. All they would have had to do was to look the other way, to play it safe, to avoid involvement. After all, certainly they weren't completely ignorant of the potential for hardship this might present to their families. And for any of us, all we may have to do is to look the other way when we see a needy situation that poses some risk for our safe lives. By simply backing away, we may well save our hides and lose our consciences. So yes, Jesus is talking to those Mennonites who had believed in him. What does it mean for us here at Center in 2016? What does it mean to continue in Jesus' teaching? In what ways are we slaves to sin? Well, we'll all agree the answers will vary. For you in the front rows, continuing in Jesus' teaching may mean mentoring a young person from Rise instead of Friday night softball or Thursday night volleyball or Tuesday night Applebee's. You are in grave danger of slavery to sin if you argue, but I can be a Christian and play softball or video games or watch a little porn. Oops, that slipped out. Slavery is also lurking if you counter with, but I can be a Christian and not read my Bible every day. All I say is beware. That's the wrong question to ask, the wrong way to ask the question. Maybe I can move back a few rows. Maybe continuing in Jesus' teaching means blessing and sending your children to Syria or Kansas City or Mexico, even though it means you won't have your grandchildren close by, even though you're nervous that your grandchildren might grow up not to be beachy. Perhaps slavery to sin for you looks like pressuring your children or grandchildren to take care of you instead of trusting God to meet your needs through the church. Moving back a little further. For you, it's possible that continuing in Jesus' teaching may mean putting off your pet project or business venture for a year or a decade. You might need to do that so that you can teach at CBS or pastor a church plant or adopt an elderly neighbor as your children's grandparent. And it's possible that for you, slavery looks like pursuing a modest Kansas Mennonite version of the American dream. Your tastes may make it hard to spot, but you have a passion for having your life orderly, manageable, comfortable, aesthetically pleasing. Don't ask me why I might have thought of that. Have I covered everybody? If you're feeling left out, talk to me afterward. Actually, I'm sure I haven't covered everybody. Let me just point out that the one specific sin that you'll find in this passage is seeking to kill Jesus. John trusted the Holy Spirit to expose the specific enslaving sins in every reader for the next 2,000 years. And I will do the same. I'm going to do something that I've never done before here. I'm going to give an invitation for anyone who wants to make a commitment. I'm going to invite you to come forward. I've never done this before, primarily because I don't think commitments that are born in the heat of emotion are very helpful. I think actually they might well contribute to the problem that Jesus is addressing in this passage. But we won't have any singing, and I'm going to give you a little time to listen to the Spirit and make a reasoned choice to come up. Don't come up just because your friend does. Don't come up just because it would make your parents or your spouse happy. We've grown up in godly families and in a godly community.